May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. In September of 1973, I left my hometown, Amherst, Massachusetts, where I had graduated from Amherst College and where I had joined the Episcopal Church at Grace Church in Amherst, and ventured to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to the Episcopal Theological School to study, hopefully, for ordination in the Episcopal Church. The Episcopal Theological School eventually merged with the Philadelphia Divinity School and became the Episcopal Divinity School, and then just a year or so ago, they affiliated with Union Theological Seminary, so they're now just up the street near Riverside Church. At the end of the first semester at ETS, the rector at Grace Church Amherst invited me home to preach. And I did, I suppose, what a typical first semester seminarian might have done in a sermon. I told him what I'd been learning and what my classes were like. And I told him about my favorite course, which was about marriage and the family and pastoral care. And I told him that we had read the most fascinating new book called Creative Divorce. It's not a typical attitude in 1973, even in the Episcopal Church. But I wasn't quite prepared for the response from one member of the congregation. As I stood greeting people at the door, she came rushing up to me and screamed, "What do you mean, creative divorce? I've tolerated that abusive man for 35 years. And then she slapped me on the face, really, really hard. I still get the shakes thinking about preaching about divorce. There are times when it would be tempting to skip over a Bible passage which has just been read in church and simply pretend that it doesn't exist or does not deserve attention. Yet if we were to skip over it, what would keep us from skipping over other parts of the Bible when we struggle with their messages? Jesus often gives hard words to the disciples and to us, and this week's gospel is no exception. The gospel begins with a difficult conversation on divorce. For many people, divorce is still hard to talk about because it radically changes the lives of not just those ending the marriage, but also their children, family members, friends, fellow parishioners, and their whole communities. Mark's original readers probably found Jesus's uncompromising statements about divorce and remarriage as challenging and countercultural as indeed many of us do today. Divorce in the first century was a generally accepted part of life, both among Jews and perhaps more so within the wider Greco-Roman culture. Some writers and public leaders spoke against divorce as bad for society, but for the most part, people debated only details of its legal basis. Among Jewish legal experts, Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 to 4 was a key text, one that assumes divorce will occur and prescribes procedures for carrying it out. But other scriptures called the possibility of divorce into question, such as in the second chapter of Malachi and in the creation story from which we heard the Genesis reading this morning. The Pharisees who ask Jesus about divorce do so to test him. The scene therefore proceeds as a confrontation in which Jesus shows the Pharisees how they have misunderstood Scripture. More precisely, they misunderstand God's design and misuse of Scripture and interpretive traditions to justify their errors. As for the Pharisees' intentions, they probably hoped their question would expose Jesus as a religious leader to various kinds of critique. Jesus turns the conversation with the Pharisees away from the legal foundation for divorce to God's design for marriage. That is, he dismisses the law in Deuteronomy 24 as a concession to human weakness and offers a different perspective rooted in creation. His brief argument describes marriage as a strong and literally unifying bond between two people. It is because he sees marriage in such a way that he speaks against divorce as he does. We need to keep in mind that divorce in Jesus' time and divorce in our time are very different. In Jesus' time, if a woman were divorced from her husband, she would be incredibly vulnerable. The world wasn't and still isn't built to protect vulnerable people. Jesus answers the questions from the religious authorities forcefully because vulnerable people are being hurt and it makes him mad. In asking them how a man may divorce his wife according to the law, Jesus is talking about what people currently knew and understood. There were structures in place to protect vulnerable populations. Yet structures created by people with good intentions often don't go far enough. Divorce, says Jesus, is an unfortunate concession to the fact that we do not always live with love and respect in marriage. Instead of having people trapped in situations where they were powerless and unhappy, divorce may happen, but it is not God's intention for marriage, so Jesus says. Jesus tells us to protect the most vulnerable among us. It seems that the disciples didn't get that memo because immediately after the conversation on divorce, they try to keep children away from Jesus' presence. Jesus speaks in support of both divorced women and the little children, people who didn't have power, both then and now. Jesus is all about being with and empowering the weakest and most vulnerable in society. The beloved community is for all people, especially those who are made vulnerable by the sometimes well-intentioned but faulty power structures of the world. The disciples, as close as they are to Jesus, didn't understand him in preventing people from bringing children to Jesus so that he might bless them. The disciples assume authority over who is in and who is out, who has access and who doesn't. So Jesus turns them around to a new way of being. Jesus welcomes those on the outside, those who are vulnerable. Such a welcome challenges our notions of who belongs in the realm of God and who is the greatest. Those whom the world calls outsiders, Jesus calls insiders, and welcomes them in the entirety of who they are. Jesus continually challenges our expectations and reminds us that inclusion is incredibly radical and incredibly important. We should recall that marriage in the ancient world, at least, among the majority of social strata, was primarily a means of ensuring families' economic stability and social privileges. By creating both offspring and interfamily alliances, a woman's sexuality was essentially the property of her father, then of her husband. During the life of Jesus, polygamy was a legal reality in both the Jewish and Roman worlds, and concubinage, essentially the taking of loosely connected partners outside of marriage, was practiced in much of the world. The Pharisees neglect to mention a key piece of Deuteronomy 24, which requires a husband to give a certificate of divorce to his ex-wife. Such a document might provide a divorced woman a defense against rumor and slander. For a majority of women in that culture, survival depended on being a member of a household, sometimes necessitating that divorced women might flee to their families of origin's home or enter some other sort of liaison with another man. The certificate of divorce might give a woman with children, but without a husband, a means of explaining why she was unmarried and thus avoid exposure to physical risk or personal judgment. Much about marriage and divorce and remarriage has evolved in the two millennia since the passage from Mark 10 was written, and its interpretation has evolved as well. We now have legal structures in most states which attempt to protect all members of a family affected by marital breakup. The Episcopal Church greatly liberalized its mechanisms for allowing remarriage of divorced persons beginning in the 1970s. Even the Roman Catholic Church has somewhat softened its use of indulgences and granting permission for remarriage. In parts of the Third World, the Episcopal Church will now baptize and confirm polygamists and their whole families as long as they don't take on any additional wives. And curiously, this practice was part of the Roman Catholic ministry in Africa long before it was in ours. Our church also takes premarital counseling very seriously, helping men and women as well as same-sex couples have greater insight into the issues in their own lives and relationships, and making them aware of when and how they can seek out professional counsel or pastoral care is a high priority. I do not officiate at a lot of weddings, but when I do premarital counseling, one of the things that I do with each couple is to teach them how to do a genogram of their family systems and then invite them to anticipate pinch points in their impending married life. I would close by reminding all of us that married couples, indeed all couples and all families and all individuals, need and deserve our personal care and support, our friendship and our neighborliness, and our regular prayers throughout each day, week, month, and year.